He spends the first year, Noah spends the first year resting in grace. So Noach means what?
Rest.
The one who rests, you see? So he couldn't get anybody to rest, and finally he starts over with a new guy called Noach, who's in the line of Adam, but he's the only father that's going to have children. And we're all children of the one who rests. You get it? So we got a calling to rest, and meanwhile, we do everything but rest. And Shabbat, cease from making your empire. Now, if we're going to start looking at the patriarchs after that, and everybody that passes under the lens in the Bible, we see people like Eliezer, people like Sarah, we see people like Jacob, and they get crashed empires. And start over. The woman's barren, she can't have a kid, let's try it through Hagar, or Eliezer, go up there and get the heir and disinherit yourself, or Jacob, where he's stripped of his company and everything he worked for with Laban, and then he's on his way. His brother's coming after him with a 400-man raiding party, and he loses his kids and his concubines and his camels and his goats and sheep and sends everybody ahead, and then he's hassled wrestling with some guy all night, and the guy goes to leave in the morning. You don't know if it's an angel, what it is. Is it Esau's angel? Is it the angel of the Lord? The guy touches him, Yisrael, but just before that he hits him on the filet mignon, hits him on the gib, hits him on the tendon, because one thing that he could do is outrun his problems, except it's catching up to him on both sides. And God frames you with your whole life, and then he has a big crisis, and he clobbers you and gets it done. And it's measure for measure when he weighs in. You're going to get what you deserve. What you measure out to others is going to be measured out to you. And if Jacob grabs and runs out, then he's going to have guys coming from both sides, and he can't run anywhere, and he's going to get stripped and knocked off. Because he's supplanting and grabbing, and he's going to have it all grabbed and taken away from him. And what you sow, measure for measure, you're going to get back to ground zero, and it's going to be a new creation. And when God's starting over with you with a new creation, you're stripped naked, you're bare, you're in trouble, your empire crashed. And so he starts over all the time, and people start over all the time. And what I'm trying to say here is, walk with God. 6 days you work. He worked, he set up a creation. During that time, he built his empire. Day seven, he rests in grace. You're being powered by grace, then you work in grace and you rest in grace. You get it? Work in grace. Work and grace aren't opposites. They're different. Rest and grace aren't opposites. They're different. So you got grace. In 6 days, you're building God's empire in grace, and maybe your empire too. Day seven, look out. If you're building empires, God isn't. You can be sure you're out of sync on that day. So better that your empire crashes on Shabbat because you're not building it. Then you build it and God comes and crashes it for you a little later. That's my big point. That's to tell you what it is to rest in grace. Get it? Grace is divine favor unmerited. You know what that means? God is kind to you. You got to be on God's kind side. Then you got to sow kindness to reap kindness. If you're not a kind person, if you're a just person, just people are not necessarily kind people. When you want justice, usually you're not asking for kindness. You're asking for revenge. You're asking to be vindicated. You understand?
That's unfair. That guy did that to me.
You don't sound kind now.
Well, it's not fair.
You don't sound kind. Now, when you're screaming and you don't sound kind, all I can say to you is you're sowing not kindness. So I wind up saying, don't blame, justify. Don't blame others and justify yourself. Praise, glorify. Praise God, glorify. Why? Because we're redeemed. That means we're pulled out of darkness into light. We're under the authority of light. It's not practical, but we're put there. We're children in the kingdom of light. God is building that. Our souls have got darkness and light. God's going to shine a light on those things. Sanctification, you abide. You're on the mountain. You're ascending. You learn to live in God's house. You learn to live on God's property. You sanctify life. It requires a little bit of discipline. But what does it really mean? It means loving life and sanctifying life. And kosher is an example. You're not going to eat a blood eater because then you're living off blood. It's not sanctifying life. And that's what kosher is about. And the whole world view that's in Torah has to do with sanctifying life. It has to do with being in God's house and living for God. And training yourself in a way where if God showed up today, You could dwell in his house. So abiding, sanctifying has to do with life on earth when God is manifest. Now, he isn't here yet. You got all the time you need. He's not manifest yet. So there aren't rules, really. You're under grace. On the other hand, are you ready if he comes back? You have freedom, but where is the freedom taking you? You see? The freedom that you have is to serve God. How? Torah? Well, to me, Torah was given to the Jewish people to live in the land when God's manifest presence is there and God picks a place for his name to dwell, and you're with him because that's your calling, and he goes over there and he dwells in this place, and then he's got a higher standard for the space in which he occupies, and those people living in that space have to live according to that criteria. Now, if you're going to come visit him, that means, you know, you observe the house rules when you're in the house. But if you're not in the house, if you're not living there, it's different. Heaven and earth will be filled with the knowledge and glory of God, but it's going to take time, and it's going to happen in his time and according to his way. And right now, the Torah has different legislation for Gentiles than for Jews. Sometimes it's stricter, and most of the time it's not stricter. Today, in Miketz, we're going to see where it's stricter for the Gentiles. When these guys were out saying, we should be killed and everybody else put in jail if we took that silver divining cup. You know what I'm talking about here? Mm-hmm. That was Torah for the Gentiles. And God turned around and said, well, Joseph turned around and said, well, Torah for the Jews is that we just take the guy that stole it and put him in jail, and the rest of the guys that are involved, it's like nothing on them. So here you had before a deeper revenge. One guy gets killed, that's a deterrent. 10 guys get in prison, that's a deterrent to keep everybody from going crazy. Torah turned the other cheek in the sense that it says, well, whether you knew about it or not, only the guy that stole it, he's going to be punished. So when Joseph says, oh, you know, I wouldn't do anything like this to you, and it's a good thing he said that because Benjamin would have died and everybody else would have gone to jail. But, you know, Joseph knew what was going on. He'd planted the cup there. But remember what happened earlier when Laban was there instead of Joseph. And Jacob is mad and he says, let the person that took at it die and the rest of us will be your servants. And they don't find it. Well, hello, somebody died. Mm-hmm. Rachel did not make it to the tomb. He cursed his own wife. Now, sure, he had something built up with Laban. So that's why I say, you know, if you're in a just world and they do something to you, you're going to be mad because it's unfair. And you're going to have chips build up and then, you know, you're looking for revenge. You're going to have a grudge. Leviticus 19:17 tells us about grudges. It says, don't hold grudges. It says you love your neighbor as yourself, but it says something before that about grudges. It says, don't have them. Don't hate. Don't hate. So I could look it up, but I don't want to go on that tangent right now. After Noah, then, grace means rest in Shabbat and let the empires crash. And so what I'm saying to us is your holy edge ought to be Shabbat. And if your holy edge is Shabbat, then that's when you're most sanctified. I mean, that's when you're living in your heart and soul where you're abiding in the light most. And what do you do to abide in the light? You pray, you're in God's face. You read the scripture, you're in God's face. 2 Corinthians 3:18, you're being conformed unto the image, the glory of Messiah. In other words, you create a little space in your life. You slow the pace down so you're not running after the phone. You slow the pace down so that the things that command your existence 6 days a week are like out on the seventh day. I use the 6-in-1 rule. Whatever I do 6 days a week, out. To me, that's melacha. Melacha is ordinary routine tasks. And what do I ordinarily do for 6 days? The things that I'm most addicted to is what I keep looking at. Anything that will be tough for me to give up. They say, well, I brush my teeth 6 days. Should I not brush my teeth on the seventh day? I say, well, does it bother you to brush your teeth? You know. Now, Wendy, you take Wendy. I mean, obviously, you know. Wendy would brush her teeth twice on Shabbat. So the important thing to realize is the 6-in-1 rule is what you do 6 days a week that puts you in bondage, get rid of it. And put God in the same space. Slow your pace down. That's what lighting candles is. You light candles going into Shabbat, going out of Shabbat. Look what you've done. You got this flickering little light. It's like I'm going to abide in the light. And look at the light. It's moving slowly. It's like the pace is slowing down. It's like I run like crazy until I slow down. And on Shabbat, it's a different pace. That's why I sleep in. That's why I have fun. Now, the Orthodox, they won't write. Why? Because writing was involved in building the temple, and it was part of building the empire. They won't write a letter, for example. And you don't. You get involved. Messianics will keep off the email for that reason. The email list shuts down. People talk all day for 6 days. Seventh day, no. Why? Because it will get you into the whole business of what you're doing all 6 days. So forget it. It's like you open up space for God instead. You create a vacuum, and it gets filled with a whole different pace and a whole different set of thinking. And you let that take on a life of its own. And that becomes your leading edge for sanctifying your life. I think what will happen at that time, it's an irony, what will happen is your empires will crash and it'll change the direction of your life a little bit. So it's very powerful, I think. And your empires are only crashing a little bit when a Shabbat comes and goes. You understand? It's not like we're talking about these cataclysmic things that happened to Judah, that happened to Benjamin, that happened to Jacob. I mean, their whole life is up for grabs when their crisis comes. I'm trying to get you away from having those kind of events. And I'm saying that if Shabbat's a leading edge, you won't have those kind of freefall crises because you'll adjust as you're going along. The Shabbat will take care of a lot of problems. All right, Lech Lecha, Abraham was called to be an Av of God's house, to walk before God and start a household. So Bereshit, God creates a universe, his rhythm is 6 and 1. Day 7, he rests in grace. Mankind doesn't, he wipes us out. Noach, the one who rests, comes, he rests in grace, solid year on the ark. He's got 52 Shabbats in there when he's resting in grace on the ark. And it's the 600th year. It's the beginning, I'd say, of 100 years, see? For a new 100 years for Noah. And the 600 years, boom. And it's the beginning of 100 years. It's going to prefigure the 6,000 and 1,000 that's coming up with the millennium. Lech Lecha, with the Tower of Babel, we try to take heaven by force. So Abraham, God comes down and says, all right, take this guy out. Let's start. And he begins taking over the world one household at a time. So how you rule your household, that's Abraham. And that's everything to do with what I call plan A for taking over the world. You get a holy household and you take over the world. You get a holy household and pass Torah across generations, you take over the world. It doesn't involve conversion. It doesn't require conversion. You're fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and when they attack you, you subdue it. That's what it requires. And you say, well, Abraham, I mean, didn't he talk to people about God? And the answer is yes, he did. He absolutely did. So, you should. But the important thing is that the real mission field starts in your house with your kids and how you run your household. That's where the mission field is. Because you've got a bunch of unbelievers, whether they like it or not, they're assigned to you. And they're assigned to you for 20 years. And they can't get away from you. That's what it is to raise children.
You can't get away from them either.
It's a two-way street, and that's important to realize what a household is, see? You say, man, my house is unglued. Okay, we'll get there. So Abraham was called to be the Av of God's house. Abraham was called to be the father of God's house. And he says, walk before me and start a household. And what's the first thing he tells him? Go crash an empire. What does he crash? Genesis 12, 1-3. Leave your family, your father's house, and your kindred, and your land, and go. Where? To a place that I will show you. Asher ani areka. To the place I'll show you. And so he takes him to Israel. But look what he did. He crashed his empire, right? Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Whatever Abraham valued, it's gone. Ur is gone. And then after that, Haran is gone. And after that, Terach is gone. And after that, it's like start over in the promised land and you're among Canaanites. And you're not a citizen. It's gone. You want a problem, whenever you think about your empire crashing, turn around and say, well, the father of God's house with Abraham, and when he started, he crashed everything. And have I lost everything? And then look around. And then stop feeling sorry for yourself. You know what I mean? No problem. Vayera, Yodevave, or an angel, the Lord appears announcing an heir, and it's saving faith. The guy says, wow, Vayera, and he appeared, saying what? We're going to knock off Sodom and Gomorrah. But beyond that, we're gonna have Yitzhak come into the world. Call him Yitzhak, and he laughed, and kings are going to come from him and everything else. Boom. This is the heir. Everybody was circumcised in Lech Lecha, and there's no heir. Vayera, and he appeared heir. Boom. It reads just like Luke. Yeshua is born, here he is, the King of Kings. And how does Luke end? You know, the crucifixion. How does Lech Lecha end? The Akedah. What's the Akedah? The binding of Isaac? Mm-hmm. Hello? And we say Isaac's a secondborn slain in faith, right? He's got the Abel card. So Abel dies, he's an Av. What kind of Av? He's got no household, he's got no family, he's got no nation, he's got no name, nothing. His name Hevel means puff, transitory, and he's the righteous mankind that never made it, killed, boom. Why? I gave a sacrifice to God, it's gone. Why? Sibling rivalry, my brother killed me. So you got the Abel card being dealt out, and it gets dealt out to Isaac, and so it's going to get dealt out to Yeshua, and Yeshua's going to come, and what is he going to say? You know who got the other Abel card at the end of the line? Zechariah, Ben Berechiah, Ben Yehoiada. Because there's four lines from Jehoshaphat down through his fourth kid, Joash, little Joash. There's four generations. And Jehoshaphat was supposedly a righteous king. His kid marries Ahab's kid. And then they have a kid in there, and you got Ahab's line, and Ahab's bad guy from Israel, means father-brother. Get that one. And father-brother is going to come crash the line. All right? Then when this guy dies, the third kid dies. So you have Jehoshaphat, then you got a son and a grandson. When the grandson dies, Adaliah gets in there, who's the mother who was married to the third guy. So the kid's out, and the mother gets in the place of the kid. And then what does she do? She says, let's go kill 70 people. We're going to annihilate all of the loins of Jacob. You see the heirs. You see the card going back. I mean, these are 70 that went down to Israel that became a nation. It's the 70 from the heads of the households of the loins of Jacob. And now the big Av is going to be the king over all that. They're going to have 70 kids that are born in this line that are potential heirs, and Adaliah is going to try to wipe them all out. And she succeeds in getting all but one. She kills 70. I guess there were 71. So little Joash is left, and how old is he? He's one. And who grabs him, the maid, and raises him? And who watches what's going on? The priest. And the priest is Jehoiada. And what does Jehoiada do when he's 70? He wheels him out and says, here's the king. And they knock off Adaliah, and they got the last Judah guy from David on the throne, and it's Joash. Now, Joash is going to go be perfect for 20-some-odd years while Zechariah is going along, while Jehoiada is going along. And Jehoiada is going to have a son and a grandson or whatever. Either he's going to have Berechiah, and then that guy's going to have Zechariah or whatever. I don't know. But the point is, Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, or the grandson of Jehoiada, whatever, is going to get born. And he's going to then, after Zechariah dies, he's going to go into the temple and say, you guys got to go back to the Torah, Joash, you went off a cliff, you forgot about all the kindness that happened, and you forgot about God, and you got altars defiled up here, and you got bad, you got to turn back to the covenant. And Joash is going to say, kill him right here on the spot. And so the kindness of the father to the son is the only reason Joash is alive, and Joash is going to grow up to kill the kind father's son. Hello, the Av card being dealt to the son, and he's going to kill, he's going to cut off Jehoiada's kid. It's worse to cut off, easier to kill Jehoiada than to kill his kid. Because you want to, which way do you want to die if you're not? You want to live through your children, or you want somebody to kill you? You want to live and have them kill your children, or do you want them to kill you and your children live?
Children live.
So it's a fate worse than death for Jehoiada that he would leave Zechariah, and the only guy he saved, Joash, goes and kills his kid. And God's looking at this, and guess what? It's the Abel card all over again. Mm-hmm. So when Yeshua comes, he says, fill up the iniquity of the fathers. You killed Abel, mankind, Jews, solving the problem of mankind. You killed Zechariah, son of Jehoiada. Another Abel card. This guy saved the son. And the son turned around and killed His father's son. And why did he do it? To grab the throne? Father, brother, you know, Israel take over Judah's throne too. See to Adaliah to go over there, an Ahabite. We want to be not only like the nations, we want to take over by intrigue and with the maternal card. We're going to marry into the line and become queen and then become king and kill everybody and put our guy on the throne and wipe out Judah on the line there and have an Ahabite in there from Israel, you see? You see the whole thing there? It's a disaster. But it's an Ab card being dealt out, and it's an Abel card being dealt out. And Yeshua looks and says, you killed Abel, you killed Zechariah, go ahead and kill me. And I'm Judah, you know, and I'm going to get knocked off. Because I'm going to be sold for silver and killed. That's what the brothers were going to do to Joseph. And Judah, you know, offered himself a surety to stop that. But then he gets betrayed by another Judah guy and killed. And now Jesus is going to get betrayed by the Judah guy and killed. I mean, he's looking at the whole thing. And he's saying, well, I'll go ahead and fill up the iniquity of the fathers. Kill me. Disciples are looking at it, and they don't get it. They walk outside and say, the temple's gorgeous, and he says, the temple's coming down. And that's the end of it. But it's a divine pathos here. Okay, look at how the whole stage is set in Genesis. You got the universe created, then you got Noah, the guy that rests, and you got Abraham, and he's the Av of God's house. And God says, walk before me and start a household. You got God appearing, announcing an heir in Vayera. And then you've got the story of Luke built right into Lech Lecha. What happens to Isaac happens to Jesus. You understand? And Yeshua, of course, his name means the one who personally saves. So you've got the one who personally saves. They'll listen to my son, right? Yeah, they're going to kill him too. And then what? Well, scratch the experiment for a while. You know, 2,000 years you got to make. Abraham was 1948 BCE. Let's wind the clock back and we'll start over with Abraham's kid and the nation in 1948 on the other side. Because you just lost 1,948 years from when I sent Yeshua to wind it out the temple. And he looks at the 30 when he's going out and he says, this generation, and it's gone.
And before, Abraham really 1948?
Yeah.
BCE?
Yeah, go count the...
Really?
What you do is you start... I know. But the way you get it, it's right in the scripture. It's not just a rabbinical thing. You can add them up for yourselves as you go in there and you say, this guy was how old when he became an Av? And then he lived how many other years? And then he had a kid, and that kid was how old when he became an Av? And you can add up all the years that the patriarchs lived and all the years that they were to becoming an Av along with all the years that they finished reading, finished going. So since you know when they became an Av, you know when the next guy started.
Yeah.
So when you have the Av in all the years, and then you have the next guy being an Av in all the years, then you can add up when each guy started, and you can get a count. And then you count it, and it's 1948 Abraham. Now that's pretty cute, because you know Genesis was written before the state of Israel came into being, right? And before the Caesar calendar came into being. So, you know, somebody's counting here, you see. Okay, so... Anyway, Chaye Sarah is the princess for Av's household. And that's the princess that rests in grace. Because, you know, Sarah, we're told her name. We're never given a woman's name. We're told her age. We're absolutely never given a woman's age. And it's 100 plus 20 plus 7 and then inherit the land. So get the picture here. A full life, a sabbatical year, and then dig in with your feet and live in faith forever, and they'll be telling you about Hebron forever. And meanwhile, it's a deed, and it's in the Torah, and if somebody tries to say that the Palestinians own it, you say the Canaanites own it, and we paid for it full price, and there are no Canaanites. And then Hanan or Shrawi has to get up and say, we're descended from the Canaanites, and they do it. And I've got an article on it. So it really kicks me out. Anyway, there you got Chaye Sarah, and they couldn't tell us better information for this whole situation. So that's a princess for God's household. And she rests in grace. And really, the whole story, after verse 2, I mean, all I did was to expand on verse 2 here in the Chaye Sarah. But the rest of it is then Rivka, who does the exact Sarah walk over the mountain and down. And you got Eliezer doing the reverse walk, because he leaves his family, Canaan, and goes up to get an heir to disinherit himself. And he's a dancing, charismatic Canaanite, because he says, oh, give me Rivka, you know, or somebody that's going to feed 140 gallons to the camels and offer me water at the same time, and then I'll know she's hospitable enough to be, you know, a matriarch to give the hospitality in God's house for the whole universe when the millennium comes in. And obviously, you know, he's a dancing, charismatic Canaanite, because it takes charisma to pray for that. And meanwhile, he's saying to God, show chesed ve'emet to my master Abraham and provide an heir. And he's happy about this inheriting himself. He's happy about his empire being crashed. So you've got a reverse empire being crashed because Eliezer leaves the land of Canaan and goes back to Haran. And then he turns around with the heiress, the matriarch, Rivka, and walks back over the Euphrates, back down to the promised land. And she gets married in the tent to Isaac, and he gets disinherited. She has seed, and it moves on. And household, so this is a household replacement plan, where first you had Abraham, and then Sarah, the princess, who becomes the princess of God, and that's a royal family, and then they have the next pair, and it's a royal household being continued across generations. And meanwhile, everybody crashed their empires, and people be happy about it. So that's why I say, read Romans 5:1-4, and be happy about tribulation, because look at these guys, the heroes of the faith, they're absolutely doing this while God is going one by one to set up holy household, to take over the universe. And it's a response to Tower of Babel, and we try to take heaven by force. He comes down and says, let's get a holy household, let's start making these guys spread out like cockroaches and take over the world. And we'll just tell them, be fruitful, multiply, and do what the cockroaches do. You understand? You get the picture here. And I'm not saying evangelism is wrong. I'm just saying, under Plan A, it's like right now, 50% of the world would be holy households. There are 284 million Ishmaelites around. And at one time, we were like, even in the Roman days, I think we were about 10% of the population. And it's like 10% of the population today would be 600 million. And if you're being fruitful multiplying, you're going to do a lot better than 600 million. So we'd be up there at 2, 3 billion, no problem. If we were keeping the covenant and passing the Torah across generations and multiplying like cockroaches. That's all. So, anyway, we're not. So we get the Toldot, the life story of Yitzhak's house, and in that, the Rav serves the younger, and it's decreed. And look at that, it's the Abel card. Because you got two guys fighting in the womb, and the woman is, Rivka is going, man, what is this? I'm a person of peace, I'm married to Isaac, he doesn't do anything. I got war in the womb. Goes to God and they say, yeah, well, you got two nations in you and the Rav will serve the Tzair. The greater will serve the younger. So Jacob, before he's born, gets the inheritance because the older is going to serve the younger. Yeshua comes back in Matthew 23:12 and he says, the humble will be exalted, the exalted, you know, they ask him, who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom? And he says, the servant, the person that's greatest in the kingdom is going to be, I don't know if they ask him, he tells them, the greatest in the kingdom is going to be the servant of all. And then he goes and says, the humble will be exalted, and the people that are exalting themselves will be brought down. That's the same principle being preached. God's going to push up the people that are down on the ground, and he's going to pull down the people that are making God out of themselves. You know, we always know pride goes before the fall. We always know when guys are exalted, we say, the guy's going to fall off a cliff, you know? Herod, they worshipped him as a god for 5 days, and then he died. Mysterious illness. He should have said, don't do that. He lived. Because that's what goes on out there. So, I mean, God's zealous about this. And, you know, a lot of people are superstitious about it. They go, you know, say something, knock wood. It's like, you know, tune in with nature here and, you know, get it off you. It's like there's things going on that people do. Why do people do all this? All just because they're superstitious. Well, it's funny how they're superstitious about being exalted or about being humble. That's one of the areas where everybody's pretty superstitious. So you got to ask yourself what's going on there. See, the Ruach is out there, and God is out there, and he is zealous to protect his glory. And you can count on it. There are a few things you can count on in this world, but one of them is gravity. One of them is death. And one of them is that God will humble the arrogant. It's just a matter of time. So, in this case, Esau winds up being told the Rav serves the younger, and Jacob gets it too, and that's Toldot. This is the life story of Yitzhak's house. So Yitzhak, Toldot, these are the generations of Isaac. Now, Abraham was the father of Isaac. That's how the first two verses are in Toldot. But really, the whole story is about the brothers fighting it out, and the Rav will serve the younger. Well, it's Yitzhak's house, do you understand? So we're talking about households. This is the life of Sarah, it's Rivka. This is the life of patriarch, and it turns out it's going to be their seed, their progeny. Because their life story, the fathers are living through the sons, and there is a vicarious drama that's playing out. So open your eyes. Abraham's seed are running around the planet right now. Abraham is alive and well in his corporate body, just like Yeshua is alive and well in his corporate body. Everybody's got representatives down here. And when the genes spill out, there's a whole drama being played out. And what they started, the problems and the curses and the blessings, are being passed across generations, and we got them still. The result is we're on the same page in the Bible right now. If you're Jewish, all over the world, we're reading the portions. It's because it goes back. to a common beginning. And there's a story. And we're all part of that story. And it doesn't matter if we're in different nations and we don't speak the same language. God keeps track and there's a destiny and we're playing out the scripts. So, after that, Jacob exits to marry a matriarch. The third time he goes back up because, Abraham came from Haran and Rivka came from Haran and Jacob is going to come from Haran and get married and bring the spouse down. And then he's going to send ahead messengers and like we say, he's going to get crumbled. And after he gets wiped out and loses everything and his empire crashes, he's named Yisrael. He walks around a limp, but he's arrived. He's becoming the patriarch of a nation. And God finished the work with him. He hammers him. So then you got Vayeshev, Jacob settles, and then we say his family unsettles. So Joseph spins off, and he's in bondage in Egypt. And Judah spins off, and he decides to go make a Canaanite household. Now God gives free will, so he'll let Judah go have a Canaanite household. But he's also going to work out his purposes. So he's not going to have that long a Canaanite household. When this woman says, Yehuda, this is the one in whom God has praised, what's going to happen? Well, she's given it to God. Now, when she glorifies God, rather than tries to say, this is the son my husband will love me, this is the son my husband has heard, now he'll love me, Levi, now he'll bind himself to me, I got 3 for 3, nobody else has any kids, I'm going to be, the grand baba, Leah, And, my husband, I know he lives through me because I have the kids and I'm the kid maker, so I'm the real wife and I'm the real matriarch and I'm the real mother. And, he's got to love me over that because, his immortality's bound up in that. Meanwhile, he says, I want Rachel and Rachel's barren. Okay, and she can't win her husband by doing that. Yeah. Any merit that you have, forget it. God will give them Alzheimer's. People will be irrational. You can count on all that. So things that you do that are merit-oriented, it's not going to work out the way you expect. When you think something's owed to you, human race doesn't pay you, and God doesn't owe you anything. So whenever you get into merit and justice, it's like, look out. You're setting yourself up for expectations that are going to crumble your empire every time. Don't live there. Don't go there. Understand you can't outgive God. So give and then forget about it. Move on. Don't keep track because then you're doing God's job. He won't like that. At some point, he'll hammer you for doing his job. It's like the minute you see that God is doing his job, the minute you see you're moving into God's territory, you're judging somebody or you think something ought to happen here, or you're mad at God because he isn't doing this, that, or the other, or you start doing it for him, the minute you're in that position, get out. He doesn't like you there. And everybody's going to shoot at you for playing God, including God. So don't do his job, and don't play God, and get out of it, and look around whenever you sit down at a poker game, and you look around, and you don't see any suckers, get up, you're the sucker. If you're walking around in reality playing God, get out of there, because it won't last. It won't last. So, anyhow, Joseph and Judah are out there, Judah's playing the, I want to raise a Canaanite household, so God says, all right. And then he starts to back it out because he can't live with it forever. So he gives Judah free will. Go ahead and have a Canaanite if that's what you want. But, I can't live with that. I want you to, give birth to Jesus, and it's not going to be 3 Canaanites. So you're creating a problem for me. Meanwhile, he's naming his kid Ur, which means awaken. It's the great awakening for Judah, because awaken dies. And then he's got Onan, and Onan's in there playing the reverse Eliezer trick. Onan is saying, if I spit the seed out on the ground, I'll be the heir. Now, whenever anybody wants to disinherit somebody, this is a problem. See, God determines who the heirs are going to be, and God's going to play God on that. And if you want to move into that position, he won't like it. Onan moved into that position. Now, look at how Eliezer, one Canaanite, and Onan, another Canaanite, played their cards. Onan had a sure thing. Spit the seed on the ground, and I win. Because I got all the cards. So God killed him. And Eliezer danced his way out to the promised land, asked God for the impossible, just give me somebody that's the most hospitable person in the universe, and I'll glorify you over it. And God says, here it is. And the guy says, holy cow, I just got disinherited, right? He went wild. He found the heir. His master Abraham's going to be happy. Chesed be'emet, covenant kindness and truth. He got out of there. Laban tried to tie him up for 22 years. He couldn't do it. Now, Jacob is much smarter than Eliezer and much craftier. Jacob can't go into Laban's territory without getting tied up 22 years. Laban goes in there and he's out in a week or less. How does he do it?
God.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did I say wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Eliezer. Eliezer goes to see Levon.
Right.
And he's out of Levon's house in less than in a week or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How's he do it so fast when the other guy going to be set up, set 20 years? It's God's story, and he says it's God's story, and the guy, before he knows what happens, he says, oh, well, yeah, we can't argue with God. That's really, God bless you. Go well. Fantastic. Then he goes, man, what did I just say? He says, listen, ask the woman something. You know, he's he got all kinds of dodges after that. Doesn't work. And the woman, Elech, it's like Lech Lecha for her, and she's out of there. Boom. He's out of there, and Levon goes, man, what happened? Some guy just came into town, ripped off the crown pearl here. You know, she used to keep things running around here. It's hospital. I can't believe what I just gave away the ranch. I'm going to get that guy when he comes back. You know, he's waiting for Jacob. Oh, boy. Oh, you're Rivka's kid? Ah, I gotcha. You know, and Jacob's coming into town. Like meets like. You want road rage? You're going to meet Levon. So Jacob got it. So he got tied up there. So then Joseph and Judah, you know, Yosef and Judah are paying to play. And in Miketz, we have Joseph. Now, when Joseph is sprung from jail here, there's this two-year gap, right, between what happened here? I want to look at that, because this is way too much. Somebody read from the scripture for me. In Vayeshev, at the very end, the way it ends, Joseph is saying, I'm really a reasonable chap. I'm very reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Verse 14, I think. That's what you mean? In chapter 40.
Chapter 40. Verse 13?
14.
14.
I think that's what you mean?
But keep me in mind, well, here he's saying, here Joseph is saying in verse 14, he's saying, look, I know about interpreting dreams, right? He says, doesn't God interpret dreams? And then he says, Sapru. Sapru Nali, right? Relate it to me. Now, it's one thing when you say, remember, we're dealing with God's story. We're dealing with God being zealous, and if you play God, he's going to hammer you. Now, Joseph is on his way to the top. You understand? So if he's on his way to the top, he's going to run Egypt, he's going to buy everybody for silver, his brothers are going to be in bondage to him for silver, he's going to be handing out banquet tickets, he's going to give five portions to Benjamin, he's going to line them up in their order, he's going to understand Hebrew, they're going to be talking behind his back, and he's going to understand it all. He's going to be like judge and God, father to Pharaoh, and judge and God to Egypt as well as to the brothers. And he's got this dream where even the father is going to come bow down to him, the father and the mother. And they store that up in their heart, that they know it was a dream. And the brothers are saying, we'll kill you over this. And they try to, but, you know, Judah steps in and does the mighty thing possible, stops them from killing him, and just has him sold for silver. It was a great move. And God's out there, okay, measure for measure. So when justice comes your way, what goes around comes around, you know, we'll save your life and sell you for silver too. You get it? Now, in this situation, Joseph's heading for the top, and he's going to have all that power? Then God's got a pretty high standard for him. A little higher standard than he would have for a guy that's running the post office. Or for a guy that's running jail. Or for the guy that's, you know, retiring. So Joseph says, keep in mind, he's saying, The actual words I want to get to are in verse 8. They said, when we've dreamed a dream and there's no interpreter for it, Yosef said to them, are not interpretations from God? Well, that's tame enough. And then he says, Sapruna Eli, right? Sapruna, relate it to me. Now, relate it to me. Who's the subject of that?
It's God.
The dreamer.
You.
You. You relate it to me. Now, where's God in that story?
Nowhere.
Not in the second line.
So he starts out, you know, God's got a hold in here, right? Tell me what's going on. And you see the little shift there?
Mm-hmm.
2 years. 2 year sentence right there. You just spent two more years in jail. Why?
And you block out the glory, like Moses at the rock.
You made the mistake of taking the glory away from God when it was an opportunity to give the glory to God. Mm-hmm. Now look, if I were in Joseph's place in jail right now, I would eat it. I'd have 2-year sentence. Because I do the same thing. After I'm set up there 10 years in jail, and I'm waiting, and they throw a pair of dreams, and I go to jail. I mean, they throw a pair of dreams at me when I'm 17 or something, and I know they're going to be real. And next thing I know, I'm out of there. I'm in a pit, and then I'm sold, and then I'm in Potiphar's household. And then they rip me off. They take my garments away again, throw me down in a jail. And I'm 10 years in the jail. I'm 28 years old, and I'm in jail. And everybody forgot about me, and I don't know nothing about nothing. I don't know where Israel is. I don't know anything besides his jail cell. And meanwhile, I'm in Egypt. It's not like, you know, somebody saying the Shema. I'm in a heathen culture, and I'm alone for 10 years in the underground where they got everybody you can imagine down there. They got rapists down there. They got guys that commit adultery. They got guys that would pick you up and throw you around. The underground of the Egyptian economy is there. And they don't care too much about some Hebrew slave that got thrown down there with the boys. So, you know, you got a lot of problems down there. And it isn't like God showing up saying, "Don't worry, Joseph, I'll take care of you." He's not saying anything to him. Joseph's in a pit. So 10 years go by, and they throw a pair of dreams at the baker and the butler. And Joseph says, "Hey, man, God finally came back. There's a pair of dreams. Hey, man, you know, I can finally use my gift here. I interpret dreams." Now, he hasn't given up, probably, on the big dream. That his brothers will bow down to him, and that his father and his mother and his brothers will bow down to him. He hasn't given up on that, because he's still interpreting dreams. He'd be pretty bitter over dreams after that. That'd be like a crashed experiment and gone. Now, he certainly had some huge setbacks, and he's certainly pretty blasted. But he hasn't given up in his belief on God, even though it's a bad scene. He hasn't given up on his belief in dreams or his ability to interpret the dreams. And the problem is, he hasn't given up on his ability. Everything else is fine, but he hasn't given up on his ability. It's good that he hasn't given up on God. It's good that he hasn't let go of the dreams. But he hasn't given up on his ability to interpret the dreams. And that's the only little thing that God wants to, like, tell him to listen. What does he give Jacob? He says, "You didn't give up on your ability to outrun your problems. So let's touch you in the hip and you will limp for the rest of your life. Now you'll figure out you can't outrun your problems, right? Front and center. I got it." Now look, I'm talking about empires. I'm talking about you, and I'm talking about what God will do to get your attention. And I'm saying that just because he did it to them doesn't mean that they're high and mighty and you're this pity little thing that you don't have to worry about because you can hide in the shadows because you're a little grass blade. You're not a grass blade, you're a human being. And every human being is vulnerable because you're made in the image of God, and he doesn't give up on little God or big God. They're all God. They're all image of God. He's not treating you like a grass blade. You're a human being, and you can't compare yourself to other human beings. Human beings are in the image of God. He doesn't care if it's a little image of God or a big image of God. If it's in the image of God, it's in his image. He's big. There's no such thing as a small mountain. If you're in the image of God, there's no such thing as an itty-bitty in the image of God person. The image of God is huge. Now get the picture here. When you're redeemed, you're transferred from the power of darkness to the power of light. That's Colossians 1, 12 and 13. Now once you're under the different power, the world is still operating under the power of darkness, but you're not. So what does that mean? That means you're under a different ethic. Now the other centered virtues are meekness, humility, all these things that are impractical in the world are other centered virtues that are light producing. And what do they lead to? Sanctification, that you're God's property and you live sanctifying life. And what happens after you're able to like abide in God's presence a little bit without just blobbing off? If you're John 15 on the tree abiding, you become a large, ripe fruit. He wants sweet fruit. That's what he cares about. He cares about who you are more than what you do. Your ministry won't mean a thing if he doesn't know you. Many will come and say, "Lord, Lord," then we cast out demons. He'll say, "I didn't know you." He used the people. He used Ananias and Sapphira. He used the high priest. to condemn Jesus. He uses a lot of people. The demons know who we are, and he uses a lot of people. The question is whether he knows you or not. We did all this mighty stuff. I don't know your thing, and you know, I don't know you. I don't know you. I don't know you, I don't know you. Goodbye. So you really got to watch out on that. Who you are. He wants ripe fruit up there. He doesn't want anybody to be least in the kingdom. He wants everybody to be most in the kingdom. He wants everybody to fit into their destiny. He wants to be a bright fruit. Sweet, tasty. And he cares more about that than anything else about you. If you don't do what he wants you to do, but you're a white fruit, he'll get done what needs to be done by somebody else, or he'll just do it. He'll decree it. Yeshua said, these rocks could jump up and start praising me. It doesn't have to be people. The rocks will do it. He's got an angelic choir up there. Billions of angels. He can get what he wants. But free will, to get a human being to be sweet, that's something else. And to get a human being to be a sweet fruit, that's something else. They got to abide on the vine, and they've got to be life. So that's why I say on Shabbat, abide and become sweet, ripe fruit. Okay? Beyond that, you got more going on here. After you're sanctified, you're going to be glorified, whether you like it or not. Now get that picture. You're going to be glorified whether you like it or not. It's going to happen to you. God does not intend to have his property up there saying we're ashamed of ourselves. And we're all walking around like dog with a tail between our legs, acting like we took a dump on the carpet. That's just not the way he wants to run his house. He doesn't want a house totally loaded up with dogs walking around with their legs and their tails between their legs. And that goes for you. He wants to have people up there really joyous, glorifying him. And it doesn't start then, it starts now. You got to get into doing it now. Because you're going to be glorified whether you like it or not. So what I'm saying is, you want to return to life. When it says, let your light shine before men, they might see your good works and glorify your Father that's in heaven, they don't care about your good works. They care about, let your light shine so other people have their light shine. You turn your light on, they turn their light on. You boast in the Lord, they'll boast in the Lord. Lead them to boast in the Lord. Your light, their light. And then a big light show going on. Works are an excuse for it. And works are doing good deeds God's way. So you do it God's way, and then you can boast in God. Now, Joseph comes close, but he's doing a good deed there, except he's not doing it God's way. He's saying, relate it to me. It's a good deed. It's a dream, and it needs to be interpreted, and will be interpreted, and he's going to interpret it.
Should have just stopped after saying interpretations of God and keep quiet to see what God...
Are not interpretations for God? Yeah, no. Well, watch what happens. Pray, recount them to me. I'm saying somebody got carved out of the subject there. Now, the story is who?
God.
So who should be in the subject?
God.
Okay, let's go to Genesis 41 and see what he learned after 2-year prison sentence. Because he says, you know, you showed us verse 14. Keep me in mind when it goes well for you, pray, deal kindly with me. You know, show me chesed and call me to mind to Pharaoh so that you brought me out of the house, verse 14. And then he gives him all the excuses and he's screaming over justice. I was stolen, just stolen from the land of Hebrews. And here I did nothing to, and they put me in this pit. And I don't care what happened to me, it's not fair. Yeah, okay, I got it, Joseph, and you're right, and boy, I'm convinced. The only problem is I'm going to have Alzheimer's and I'm going to forget everything that just happened. And you're right, the dream's going to come true and I'm going to be restored. So he's out of there, and Joseph got it out of his system, that justice bit, and, you know, he got it all out, and he did it perfect. Remember to meet a Pharaoh, and I did this, and it was unfair, and finally I should be out of here, and I can help, I'm a big man, I'm important. And the guy goes, no, goodbye. And he gets out, and the other guy gets killed, and you'd think that would affect human behavior? Human behavior is, what have you done for me lately? I'm out of jail, that guy's dead, that's all in the past. What's in the present? I don't need Joseph, he's in jail, it's a hassle. Talk to Pharaoh, forget. He's out of there. Now Joseph got it out of his system, but God said, well, you know, the story's about you, see what's going to happen. You interpreted the dream. Now look, let your light shine before husband, you know, shine before men, he did, that they might see your good works, he did, and glorify your Father that's in heaven. It didn't work. Why? Relate it to me, change the subject. The story got onto Joseph. The guy saw Joseph was a loser. He left, Joseph loses. The minute he switched the subject from God to Joseph, even though Joseph used his gift and said, political, you know, you owe me one now because, you know, I comforted you and for 3 days, you know, you owe me your life, and then it came true and that came from God. That's proof that I'm, you know, God's servant interpreting the dream. So now, get me out of this pit. Nothing. You get the picture here? It couldn't be closer to the truth. The only problem is this two-year gap when nothing happens. So then nothing happens, and 41 starts over, and we're in the Miketz. In 41, now at the end of 2 years of time. So it says the chief cupbearer did not keep Joseph in mind, verse 23. Mm-hmm. He forgot him. Alzheimer. That's the end of the chapter. 41 starts. That's a new portion. Vayahi. Now came about. Miketz in a time, Yamim. At the end of 2 years of days. I mean, I can just hear Joseph counting the days, you know. I'm out of here. Tomorrow. I'm out of here. For sure. Tomorrow. Count to 730, Joseph. I quit after 30. After 30, I was suicidal. After about 430, I thought, I'm going to rot in jail. It's like God sent a pair of dreams. I knew what was going on, and it didn't happen. It's like, what is going on? So at the end of 2 years, Pharaoh gets the pair of dreams. Now look at this. The dreams now go right to the head of the house. Paro means big house. Last time he sent it to his sars. The sar over the bakery in the kitchen. The sar over the cupbearer, who's the top administrative lieutenant and a judge. He's a very important guy, this cupbearer, the butler.
When you say sar, you mean prince?
Yep. And this is the court. And the sar is on his way, you know, serving the empire in the administrative machinery of the administration of a king. And that's a sar. And you know, Yisrael and Sarah, God's got the same thing going in his house. Get it? So here, and Sarah means mastery. So you prevailed over God and man. Yisrael. Yisrael. That kind of thing. So now at the end of 2 years, here he's standing at the Nile stream. And, you know, that's kind of funny, the Joseph story. I saw seven fat cows coming out of the Nile. Joseph's coat of many colored dreams. And cow is actually means year in the Egyptian hieroglyphics. You see a cow up there, they're talking about a year. So the guy's hearing seven cows, and, you know, it's a generation, it's 7 years, and so on. So fair to look at. And when I'm talking about generation at seven, I'm saying like a new creation for an individual. To me, 7 years is like it was 7 years for little Joash to grow up and become king. It's like seven is, I think in your life, between sabbatical years, it's like it's a new beginning for an individual. So at the level of a person, to me, seven is like a generation, and you're living, times are all short now, and 70 years, 10 generations, like 70 years for your life. Seven cows, and they were they did all this stuff. So Pharaoh woke, and he fell asleep and had a second dream. And this guy's having a bad hair night. He wakes up, and he's really blasted out. And then he starts telling the court, and he asks them what it means, and nobody can get it. And you can be sure that the pressure's on in the court. And Pharaoh says, you know, I'm going to kill somebody around here. So the cupbearer decides he doesn't have Alzheimer's anymore. Then, verse 9, the chief cupbearer spoke up to Pharaoh, saying, I must call my faults to mind today. I mean, he's under pressure to say, I must call my faults to mind. He wouldn't be calling it a fault. Oh, you know, it just came to me. Pharaoh was once infuriated with his servants and placed me in custody. He was once infuriated, you know. Verse 10, he's never been infuriated since, including now. He doesn't get mad, but he was once infuriated. In the house of the chief guard, and myself and the chief baker, we dreamt a dream in a single night. I and he, we dreamt each man according to his interpretation. Now there was a Hebrew lad, a servant of the chief. We recounted him, and he interpreted our dreams. So was each man according to his dream, he interpreted. And thus it was. His interpreter, so it was. I was thrown in my position. That guy was hanged. That's compelling. Pharaoh sent did Joseph here immediately. They brought him hurriedly out of the pit. Now, it was 2 years to the day. It's Pharaoh's birthday. So originally, 3 days from now, you guys are going to go. It's a veritable resurrection for that guy. He's out of jail. Now, 2 years later, on Pharaoh's birthday, another pair of dreams going into the head of Big House, and Big House is agitated, and Big House, Pharaoh, calls his troops, and the chief cupbearer suddenly remembers, and now Joseph's life can begin to pick up where it left off exactly 2 years ago. Now understand, God is open-ended. He'll give it as much time as it takes. He sent the dreams. He sent the dreams again. Joseph has figured out a few things about God and pairs of dreams. Verse 14, Pharaoh sent and had Joseph called. They hurriedly brought him out of the pit. He shaved, changed clothes, and came before Pharaoh. Now, when you shave a guy, you know, Nazarite vow, they do that. And then what do? They take the clothes, and he got new clothes. What do they give him? Shesh. Egyptian linens. The exact stuff the high priest wears. So you're Nazarite, you're high priest, and boom, you're up there, you're number two in Big House. Big House gives it all to you. You got Egypt, bang! You're the priesthood, bow! I'm not a Cohen. You're in charge! All right, I'm in charge. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter for it. He says, man, I heard those exact words. I mean, exact words. Who said that last time? The chief cupbearer said that. And Joseph's going, man, I've been there. I know if I give the same response, I'm going back to the camp. I really got it figured out. I had my 2-year sentence here, and I don't want to repeat this one. But I've heard it said of you, and this is the big man coming at him, Pharaoh, that you but need to hear a dream in order to interpret it. And Joseph's response is, not me. Hey, not I. The subject is, not I. The subject is, not I. I repent. Not I. Can you say that again, Joseph? Not I. And then who's the subject? God will answer when it's for Pharaoh's shalom. God will answer. And you know, I was talking to Dan Stroll about this yesterday, and he said to me, you know, he wasn't even talking about a dream. He says, God will show you what's going to happen. In other words, God's using the dream. He pulled it right out of the dream here. God will show you. Put it right into God's story now. You see? It didn't even, forget the gift. You see? God will show you. And suddenly you're free from, here's the work, which can sidetrack you into, I did the work. It's like, let your light shine. That means like, Yehuda, this is the one whom God has praised. So that others will glorify your Father. Your Father. Not their Father. Your Father. Good leader leads a person to his God. But it's God's story. You just make sure if it's your God, it's his God. Because it's your God, it's fine. Not the God of Nahor, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Micah. And then Jacob, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, he's going along here. It's not I, God will answer what is for Pharaoh's welfare. Pharaoh spoke to Joseph. In my dream here, I was standing on the bank of the Nile. And there were 7 fat cows coming out of the Nile. Bobbed you up, bop, bop, bobbed you up, bop. And here out of the Nile were coming up 7 cows and all this, and they were... And then the 7 gaunt guys came and ate the 7 guys. I mean, cannibalism here. It's horrible what's going on, right? And then he woke and he says, same thing happened with 7 ears. Joseph's had these dreams about stalks and ears before, you know. Remember, I said Isaac gave him the corn futures card. You know, this guy had corn futures coming to him. See the Av card getting dealt to the grandson? Isaac sowed and reaped 100-fold, Genesis 26:15. And now Joseph, the grandson, is getting corn futures in Egypt. In fact, with corn futures, he's going to cash out big time, and he's going to buy all the Egyptians. Because he's going to have the corn futures, and then he's going to get all the silver. And then after that, he's going to get all the Egyptians, because they're going to run out of silver, and they're still going to be selling themselves. And Pharaoh's on his way way up. And Joseph's on his way way up. And they're powering by these dreams that God gave him, like, as a heritage a long time ago. This guy's an heir, and he's beginning to inherit. But in order to inherit, what did he have to remember? Number one, you could die in jail. Number two, the story's not about you. The story's about God. Here, 7 ears were going up on a single stalk and all this stuff, and the lean ears swallowed up the good ears and all this. And then you get the picture of what's going on here.
I'm sorry. The thing that I'm mystified about is Jacob's corn.
Not Jacob, it's Isaac. Isaac. Because Isaac stayed in the land and reaped 100-fold.
Right.
It was a famine.
Right.
And what I say in that is he had 3 wells, they had contour plowing, he probably had half the crops, and everybody else had no crops. A one-eyed man in a world gone blind is king. This guy got 200 times for the corn because everybody's blasted out. And he reaped 100-fold because he got 50% times 200. He got 100-fold. Okay. The guy made a fortune out there. And you know, it's because he stayed in the land and he didn't go get another Hagar and 280 million more Egyptians so he could have 560 million Arabs surrounding the promised land right now. I mean, he really made it a lot easier on us right now. We'd be looking at 600 or 700 million of those guys instead of 300 million. You understand? Boy, aren't you happy?